Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Genetics Podcast. I'm really excited to be here today with Jake Rubens, who's the origination partner at Flagship Pioneering, co-founder and president of Quotient Therapeutics, founding CSO of Tessera, who we had on the podcast previously, and also a co-founder of Sana Therapeutics. And I'm really excited to have Jake on today. We're going to focus on Quotient Therapeutics, which is a recently launched company that focuses on somatic genomics, which is a field that has, I think, burst to the fore in the last couple of years and has overturned some pretty amazing insights into biology that hopefully turn into therapeutics soon. But Jake's a serial entrepreneur, has been involved in quite a few pretty amazing companies. So first of all, I'd just like to say welcome, and I'd love to hear your backstory. How did you get into this, and maybe what's the binding thread or organizing principle behind these companies that you've helped to start?
Thanks, Patrick. It's absolutely wonderful to be here. I'm excited to talk about Quotient and tell you a little bit more about how I think about creating breakthrough companies. So we run this amazing process at Flagship for conceiving, founding, and then building companies that can create products that someday can help people in the areas of therapeutics and healthcare, sustainability, and agriculture. And we run a process that enables us to come up with these insights, but it takes a lot of time to actually come to those problems that, when you see them a little bit differently from the rest of the world, enable us to push forward in an area where people are not yet paying attention. So what I tell the teams that I work with is to try to choose really important problems. And problems where we get to the core, get to the heart of the challenge, where if that problem is solved, it could open up not just one or two, but many different first-in-class or best-in-class therapeutics. And that problem is really only half of the solution or half of the insight. We also need to find the solution. We need to find the solution to the problem where there are many ways that we can be wrong and yet still be right. That is to say, a solution where we can go down many paths, hit dead ends, and yet still have confidence that in going forward, we're going to find a path to enormous value. And ideally, there should be a rare or unique insight that we have associated with that solution. So for me, it's been very clarifying to focus on the genome. I've started 5 companies, 3 of which you mentioned at the outset, a couple of which are still in stealth mode here at Flagship. And all 5 of those have a meaningful basis in genome science. And the reason why that is the case is, one, I love genome science, so that's a straightforward one. But the other is that it is the most powerful molecule in biology. Our DNA is the most powerful molecule in biology. Learning from it, modifying it, almost guarantees powerful insights and eventually drugs that can emerge from those insights. And we can increasingly, with very high confidence, know exactly how a change in our genome impacts biology, enabling us to rationally design drugs, including those that edit the genome directly or add new genes to our genome. And that's because this code is digital. There's 3 billion different letters in that code, where every single one of those letters has 4 possible states that can be encoded in 2 bits, an A, a T, a G, or a C. And today we have more than 1 million copies of those 3 billion sequences for humans, and many more beyond that for distinct animal and single cellular genomes. And it's estimated by some folks that by 2025, this will be 40 exabytes of data. And each exabyte is 1 billion gigabytes. So that's a lot of data. And to put that in perspective, it's estimated that all of the words ever spoken by humans could be stored in just 5 exabytes of data. And a fraction of all of those exabytes has been the basis for training artificial intelligences and large language models, which are at this point astounding us as scientists and as, you know, broader human community with what they can do. So what we have begun to imagine is all of the insights that we will be able to make from the 8 times more data we have about genome sequences than the spoken word, and the types of insights that with augmented artificial intelligence, we as scientists can make about the genome. So I'm super excited by genome sciences as a basis for these insights that can provide solutions to important problems. And I'm excited to share one of those with you today in the form of quotient.
Tell me about the kernel of, I forget exactly how you phrased it during the intro, but there's some kind of core problem that you need to solve, or a mystery maybe at the heart of biology or genome science. And if you're able to solve it, then it leads to first in class or best in class medicines. What was that in the, you know, in the realm of somatic genomics that had you all thinking maybe there's a big opportunity here?
Yeah. So in somatic genomics, it's worth going back a little bit in time. When we started Quotient a couple years ago, we had become excited by the emerging data from folks like Matt Nelson, who I believe you've spoken to, who had shown that there was a much higher probability of success for drugs making their way from discovery through commercial if they target a target that is validated by genome science. And this is something that was not a unique insight to us, but what began to kind of click on the light bulbs in our minds was the realization that genetic diversity also takes place within us and not just between us. It has only been in the last 5 years that this has been appreciated at any level. There was good basis to perhaps predict that there was meaningful genetic variation between cells in the body because, you know, a cell doesn't go from having zero mutations and not being cancer to having hundreds of mutations and being a cancer cell. There is an intermediate state. But we hadn't yet been able to observe this due to the technology not yet existing. And so we began to investigate this space in earnest in 2021 with an exploration at Flagship. And it became apparent immediately that there was something really interesting about the insight that each of us contains not just one genome, but 30 trillion genomes, a distinct genome inside of every single cell in our body. And just thinking through the math behind that, that means that at average numbers of the mutations that exist in each cell, every single base pair in our genome, in our 3 billion base pair genome, has been mutated 30 million times inside of each of us. And we really do comprise this incredible genetics library. Now, that is just kind of the observations that had been emerging in academia and are well supported now by many different academic groups. Look at any tissue in the body, there's high rates of somatic mutations. And what we began to wonder at Flagship was whether we could actually observe evolution, whether we could look at distinct changes in the prevalence of these genomes within an organ and use those insights to understand the path of disease and how cells might cause or be protected by disease. And at the time that we began to start Quotient, we weren't aware of anyone else having made that insight. And that's what got us really excited. That was the problem, and then the problem being new genetic targets, the solution being this insight that we could learn from the genomes inside of us. That got us really excited about building what became Quotient.
Yeah, I mean, there's two interesting examples that spring to mind that I'm curious if you guys are thinking about these. At ASHG last year, there was a really amazing talk looking at the Huntington's repeat expansion and how that, you know, how that evolution basically happens in brain cells of effectively that the clock behind the repeat expansion, how it goes slow and then all of a sudden very fast. And then the other one, which I'm almost positive you are deeply intertwined with, is this story about NASH and somatic mosaicism in the liver. I think you've got scientific co-founders or collaborators involved from that group. But maybe with one or both of those examples, you could talk through how understanding this evolutionary process within the body might give you some kind of insight on how we could treat disease.
Yeah, great examples. And they're both wonderful. Yeah, I am very familiar with the NASH example you mentioned, Patrick, because the first study of NASH somatic genomic diversity was published by our academic co-founders at the Sanger Institute. So as we had begun to think of what Quotient could become based upon this insight about evolution and learning about disease, we began to speak to folks in the field and connected with Peter Campbell eventually, and Hao Zhu at the University of Texas Southwestern, who had begun to also to actually had begun to observe in their own academic work these types of insights that we were dreaming up only on paper at this point. And around the time that we were starting the company, Peter ultimately published his a paper in Nature describing the observation of somatic genome evolution in the context of NASH, and how that could reveal somatic mutations that appeared to protect cells from the course of disease. One of those genes they identified, it's a gene called SIDE-B. They identified from looking at roughly 29 patient samples and concluded at a p-value of 10 to the negative 16 that this gene was associated with protection from NASH, at least the single cell level. And I mentioned this gene specifically because about a year later, in the New England Journal of Medicine, Regeneron published an updated analysis of the UK Biobank, where they looked at close to 550,000 patient genomes. And from this data set, also identified the same gene SIDE-B as being protective against liver disease at a p-value of 0.04. And so, you know, the difference in cohort size and the difference in statistical certainty with which associations were being made in somatic genetics and population genetics is something that we found very validating and very encouraging for the path that we were headed down.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I guess this touches on one of the questions I was going to ask, which was about the relative advantages and disadvantages of, you know, the germline GWAS studies that we talk about a lot on this podcast and in general versus looking into somatic genomes for target and drug discovery. Maybe you can talk a little bit more. Sample size, it sounds like, is one big advantage that you have. I guess challenging potentially to get access to the right tissues, but if you only need 29 of them to make a discovery like this, then that's not so many. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the pros and cons of the approach.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And we at Quotient view those two approaches, somatic genomics and germline genetics, as extremely complementary. We think that they reveal aspects of the problem that neither reveals alone. So when we speak specifically about the advantages of somatic genetics, it's not to necessarily say that there aren't advantages of population genetics. Yes. In fact, we think they're really complementary. So the first advantage or potential advantage we speak about is the power of the method, less samples or less sequencing, more powerful insights. SIDE-B and the story I just described is an example of that. The second is that there's this incredible intrinsic validation that comes from disease biology directly selecting the mutations that we observe in our data sets. So when we sequence a sample from a patient and compare it to control samples where there is not disease, we see selection directly associated with the disease on those patient samples. And when we compare that to, say, germline genetics, it's hard to say that the disease has actually been selecting for the genome that we observe, which is why we need to look at so many different genomes that are there. And then it's hard to directly say this change led to this phenotype in this patient. We can do that with much more confidence with the somatic methods. And then the third really great aspect of the approach is the incredible precision that with which we can draw conclusions, in that in GWAS, most of the time, the data sets look at SNPs across the entire genome. And most SNPs that are strongly associated with a phenotype are actually not in genes, they're adjacent to genes. And it's hard to know how any one of those SNPs is going to change the gene in question. Is it upregulated? Is it downregulated? Is it just neutral and happens to be linked to the gene and the phenotype for some reason? Whereas with our somatic genomics method, we get this exacting resolution of changes to genes themselves. So when we say a gene is selected by a disease, we see mutations in the gene, we see patterns of mutations in the gene, and sometimes we even know that there's a particular amino acid in the gene that matters more than others, and a particular amino acid change to that amino acid location that matters more than others. So when it comes to designing drugs, it's very easy to go directly to a therapeutic hypothesis informed by that genetics. Now, there are limitations, of course, to our approach, which is where population and / germline genetics is very complementary. Some of those is that it's challenging sometimes to extrapolate from the insights we have on a single cell or population of cells to whether it's helpful for the organ or the organism in which those genetic changes occur. And so we leverage other insights into biology, including germline genetics and transcriptomics and other types of, you know, literature about any given gene to confirm that, you know, what we are hypothesizing may ultimately become a great drug target. You mentioned sample access. That is critically important for what we do. And ideally, we are working with collaborators to form prospective cohorts who are bringing samples to us focused on the specific disease and patient cohort of interest. That takes time. It's hard to find those collaborators. And so a lot of the work that we've done up to this point has been to access collections of samples that were made previously, but we're really excited about those prospective collections going forward.
Yeah, and where are the similarities and differences between, say, somatic genomics and oncology? Maybe you can talk through some of the things that, you know, you've taken from the major progress on in that field over the last couple of decades, where obviously somatic genomics maybe dominates over the germline and in many cases in terms of what are the core drivers. But some of the diseases we're talking about, like NASH, which I should have mentioned earlier, is a liver disease, but many of the others that I think you're looking on aren't oncology, or you're certainly not restricted to oncology. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what's the same and what's different between those two worlds.
Good question. So we have made a lot of progress in NASH well beyond what our academic co-founders have published. We've made a lot of progress in various other liver disorders, a lot of progress in autoimmunity, a lot of progress in immuno-oncology, infectious disease, just to name a few. So we think this is going to be super widely applicable. Right now, we're very excited about neurodegenerative diseases like Huntington's that you mentioned earlier, where there is good reason to think that somatic genomic evolution plays a large role in the pathology of the disease or the protection from it. And we're even excited about areas like aging, where this incredible entropy that we can observe on the sequence of our genome is certain to play a large role in the entropy we observe in our bodies over yes. the course of our lives. And yes, of course, we are also interested in cancer. And we actually have some interesting insights we're making at Quotient about cancer from the somatic genetics lens as well, which we aren't quite yet ready to speak about, but hopefully will be soon. And our academic co-founders, specifically Mike Stratton and Peter Campbell, have a really deep history in cancer somatic genetics. They're actually responsible for some of the first cancer somatic genome sequences. And so all of the insights they've made about somatic genetics from their cancer world have flowed naturally into what we do at Quotient. And there's some very basic aspects of that, such as how you build the bioinformatic pipelines to actually find out true positives and separate those from false positives. Yeah. That I think has saved us a lot of heartache over time that most startups, at least ones I've been part of, tend to run into at some point. And it has also really opened our eyes about how we can use the sequences that emerge from our data sets to actually learn about biology. I mentioned before this exacting resolution of our method and how the patterns of mutations tell a story. This is something that the cancer genetics field pioneered. So one of our academic co-founders, Peter, is like unbelievable at looking at a pattern of mutations in a gene and saying, oh yeah, this makes sense because of where these are all clustering is in this domain. And this domain of this protein is responsible for phosphorylation of this other protein. And since all the mutations are linked right here, that means it's probably not phosphorylating this other protein. Therefore, this is what's happening in the disease. And he's able to get all of that from just looking at the pattern of mutations from a small number of patient samples and, you know, 100 different mutations in total from one disease. And that I think has come from their experience in the cancer genetics field.
What maybe you can talk a little bit about that method. How do you go from a tissue biopsy or maybe it's a culture? You tell me how you can do these things if the tissue's not so easily accessible and then pull that pattern out the other side that then allows you to make these biological hypotheses that you can then go test empirically, right? Maybe tell me a little bit about that method.
Totally. So this is getting to the core of our somatic genomics platform. There are four steps that we follow in the platform. The first is phenotyping. And here we look for a particular phenotype of the cells that is associated with health or disease. So in some circumstances, that is expansion of cells that have some healthy benefit compared to their compatriots. In others, that is localization of cells into a tissue. So a good example there is the lymphocytes that penetrate into the parenchyma of an inflamed tissue in autoimmune diseases versus lymphocytes in circulation. That localization phenotype is telling for us. And then a third is actually looking for a particular pathological marker associated with the disease, say the presence of misfolded protein in a neurodegenerative disorder. And what we do is separate in the second step, we separate the cells of interest. So this is isolation. And to accomplish this, our workhorse is something called laser capture microdissection, which is this absolutely wild technology that makes it possible to look at a tissue slice under a microscope and use a laser to cut out as few as a single cell from that tissue. And so if we can, from our phenotype step, find the cell that has properly folded a protein, whereas all the other cells around it have misfolded the protein, we can then cut out that single cell. Third step is sequencing. And here we are leveraging a technology called nanorate sequencing, or NanoSeq for short. It was invented by our academic co-founders at the Sanger Institute. Inigo Martin-Corena was really the mastermind of developing that. And the technology is capable of identifying a somatic mutation that is prevalent in as low a frequency of 1 in 1 billion alleles. And so that's about 10 million times greater sensitivity than standard next generation sequencing. And it's the level of resolution necessary to make the types of insights that we're making about somatic genome evolution within the body, and probably is necessary to make these insights for any disease outside of oncology. The fourth step is then computing. And here we've built bespoke bioinformatic pipelines that are designed to take that NanoSeq data and process it, and then to integrate that data with other types of data sets, such as transcriptomic data sets, germline genetics data sets, which together we run meta-analyses on to inform us about targets. So that four-step process, phenotype, isolate, sequence, compute, that is our workhorse platform that allows us to go from unique cells through specific target at quotient.
That's super clear. On that third step of sequencing and the level of resolution you get, why is it so important to have that 1 in a billion resolution? What is it that you miss if you don't have that?
So most of the somatic genetic diversity occurs at that low copy number, in that outside of oncology, there isn't frequently this incredible positive selection or expansion of a cells that all have the exact same genome. So if you take a slice of tissue out of a liver, and it's a good one to speak about since we've been discussing it already at length, no mutation is likely to be prevalent in more than a few of those cells. Let's say 1%, the best case scenario. Sometimes if you're very precise, you can observe mutations that are prevalent in as much as, 5 to 10% of a tissue slice. But that's really, really rare. And on top of that, it's very rare that any single mutation is prevalent across all those different cells. There may be many different mutations on the same gene. And it's the identification of the specific mutations that is necessary to make conclusions about the genes, which are recurrently mutated at different sites across that tissue slice or across that organ system.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here. I haven't read the NanoSeq paper, but how does the method actually work, if you have a sense from a high level of how you achieve that kind of incredible resolution?
So what it enables us to do is, with great confidence, remove any artifacts from the sequencing by synthesis method, which next generation sequencing is based upon.
Yeah, I see. So it's a really effective way at filtering out noise passengers that if you didn't filter them out would just completely swamp any signal that you had.
That's right. So there's two major sources of the noise. And my co-founder, Simon Bruner, who I believe you know from your time together at the Sanger, he is the mastermind of our platform. And so you may correct me later. But there's two main sources of noise that are introduced by typical sequencing methods. One is in the amplification step, just copying DNA introduces errors. The other is that the process of of shearing the DNA to attach the ligating to it, the adapters for sequencing, introduces additional errors.
Right.
And this method, NanoSeq, controls for both of those major sources of noise.
Yeah, super. That's fascinating. I'm going to go read that paper and get into the details. Nice. What is the bottleneck here? Is it access to tissues? Is it your imagination? What stops you from applying this? Because you can apply it to almost any tissue or therapy area, right? In practice, or maybe you tell me where are the limits to this?
So we don't see limits. We see kind of friction that we need to kind of push through, right? So ultimately, I think that this approach to these insights are going to be close to limitless in how we can learn about human biology with them. Some of the sources of friction we're pushing through today are, of course, sample access, we already mentioned. The other is really unlocking this capability to identify extremely unique cells that are rare and to isolate them and separate their DNA. You know, I mentioned this example where we would find the neuron that has properly folded, say, TDP43 in a disease like ALS, where misfolding of TDP43 is pretty strongly linked to the pathology of the disease. Finding and isolating that specific neuronal cell is a challenge, and it's something that we're working through at Quotient. And one of the really exciting ways to get there that we've been dreaming about recently is the possibility that we can leverage computer vision. So the same types of very exciting technologies that folks at, say, Recursion have pioneered for in vitro phenotypic screening, that is to say, identifying the cells in the dish that look different than the others, we believe is just as applicable to samples of human tissue to find the neurons that look interesting and very high throughput. And then to enable machines to autonomously isolate those cells and then feed them into the rest of our pipeline. So I think we're going to get to that vision in the not too distant future. And that's where a lot of our technology development efforts are focused at the moment.
That's super interesting because it sounds like one of the holy grails of germline genome sequencing is you find the genetic superheroes, right? That we call them, which are the people who should have X disease, but they have a protective variant. But you're doing that, but on an individual cell scale. So you're looking for the cellular superheroes in a way that the germline genome suggests that they should have misfolding TDP43, but actually this cell has rescued the phenotype, and the question is why, right? And that answer to that question could have a whole a whole new target and thread for you to pull on. Is that a good way to think about it?
Yeah, that's an incredible way to put it. I love the genetic superhero analogy, and just based upon pure numbers, all of us have those genetic superheroes inside of us. The patients who have these diseases probably have many of these genetic superheroes inside of them. And we just haven't yet had the technology to resolve that. And that's really what we're pioneering here at Quotient. Now, the flip side of that is we probably also have every disease inside of each of us.
Yes.
There's this incredible Simpsons short from that we used to reference back in the day at Quotient, where Mr. Burns is at the doctor. And the doctor comes in and he says, "Mr. Burns, this is unbelievable. You have every single disease known to man." And the joke is that he actually has none of the diseases, because it's sort of like all of them trying to push through a door all at once and getting stuck in the door frame. And we used to watch that video as we were just conceptualizing Quotient, because we thought it was actually probably right. We actually all do have every one of these diseases, but no one of them is prevalent enough for them to manifest as disease, unless there's opportunities for great cell expansion, like there is in oncology, and like there may be in autoimmune diseases, as another example.
Interesting. When it comes to hard to reach organs like the brain, for example, are you able to do this by building culturing organoids or something like that, or ideally would you need primary tissue? And of course, it sounds like you could probably combine these things downstream. But what do you get from organoids or other kind of less realistic, but maybe more accessible models of tissue?
Interesting question. We've been very focused on the primary human samples, because for the vast majority of human biology, there's going to be some loss of fidelity of the model system compared to the human example itself. Now, there's certainly going to be some crossover point where the fidelity is good enough and that the human tissue is hard enough to get that it makes more sense to do it in a dish with organoids or other methods like tissue slices, right? But for now, most of our focus has been on the human samples.
Yeah, that makes total sense. We you mentioned this earlier, actually. We had Matt Nelson on episode, I think it was 118 on the podcast, and he made a really interesting claim that he thought the next big leap forward in using genetics to power drug discovery on a germline basis was probably going to be when we get to hundreds of millions of genomes, because, you know, that we just need to reach a level of scale that we can do some of the things you're talking about, really find the needles in the haystack, whether they're protected individuals or rare and highly impactful, you know, modifier variants. But based on what you're saying, it seems like maybe there actually could be a different route where if we understand genetics through the evolution that's happening in every tissue in the body, that could be a totally independent vector that gets us there faster. I'm wondering your perspective on that. Obviously, we'll continue to push on the germline side, but should there be maybe more effort put behind the somatic genome side, because it's pretty largely untapped to date?
Yes, definitely yes. And it's a fascinating perspective. So I think the two methods really build off each other nicely, and that some of the most powerful insights we've had about targets has been when we've done meta-analyses. Yeah. Of somatic genomics data sets and population or germline genetics data sets. In some cases, we can take our insights from somatic genetics and use those to do statistically more powerful restricted hypothesis testing of population genetics. And then suddenly the population genetics signals, which are in the noise, rise above. And those have tended to be very interesting targets from our perspective, because we have this kind of cross-validation between the two methods. So I think that it may be that with somatic genetics, we actually need less population genetics data to get to the level of insights, or together they get us to insights sooner than the 100 million genomes that maybe Matt described. But I also think that we need a lot more gas on the fire for somatic genetics. Quotient is the first commercial entity pushing forward the science, as far as I'm aware. And actually, we were ahead of the NIH by many respects in doing this. I believe it was last year the NIH announced a new initiative called the SMAT initiative. I'm saying smart with a Boston accent, but it's actually spelled S-M-A-H-T. It stands for somatic mutations across human tissues, S-M-A-H-T. And they're investing the NIH is investing $140 million into developing the science of somatic genomics within the United States. So I think there is going to be a very powerful rising tide here over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think Quotient and you know, all of population genetics, frankly, will benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was curious to hear a little bit more just about your approach to building companies, finding interesting problems to work on. I think you framed it really well at the start. And this actually, at the start of my PhD supervisor gave me not too dissimilar advice, which was to pick a problem to work on where, whether the answer was yes or the answer was no, you were still going to find something interesting. And I don't think that's a great for a company. I think it's really good for a PhD student. You can publish a paper that says we looked at this and we found yes, or we found no. With a company, you kind of do need the answer to be yes, or at least find out that it's no as quickly as possible. But you know, you've co-founded, I think you said, 5 companies. What have you learned? What were some of the mistakes you made in company 1 or 2 that you're correcting in 3, 4, 5 that you've learned along the way?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd say it's worth going back to company 0, which was when I went into grad school at MIT. I was very excited to kind of live out this dream of pushing forward the frontier of synthetic biology in building out gene circuits that could enable cells to do computations and calculations. And we made some great insights there. And I began to dream that those insights could be the basis for a company. And I ended up being dead wrong about that. So this is company 0. And it's interesting because, you know, academics are actually really well primed to be entrepreneurs. Jason Kelly at Ginkgo was the person who I heard say this first. And it's because coming out of academia, PhDs or postdocs, they already work their butts off. They don't expect to make a lot of money or to be paid a lot. And they are already very passionate about something that very few other people care about at all. Mm. So they're actually like well set up to be entrepreneurs. But the reality is most have no idea what a great business looks like. And I was exactly in that boat. So I had the stuff, but I didn't have the brain or experience to do it. And that's despite having taken every class that MIT Sloan Business School offered on biotech startups and right. biotech entrepreneurship, even getting a healthcare certificate from them for having taken so many courses. And what I didn't do a great job of is actually going out and getting feedback from people who were already entrepreneurs and investors who could really apply strong selective pressure to my own ideas and help me evolve it. So ultimately, I decided that I didn't know enough to do this myself, and I didn't love the idea that I was working on. So instead, I came to Flagship, and the main draws for me was to learn from biotech entrepreneurs that had started many successful companies, folks like Noubar Afan and Jeff von Maltzen, who I've been working with now for more than 8 years. And the other main attractant for me was the opportunity to start companies from a blank sheet of paper, as opposed from a scientific paper. Because when you start from a blank sheet of paper, you can ask really hard questions without all of those years and blood, sweat, and tears you had already put into a project that you're trying to, you know, find a path forward for it. And when you start from that blank sheet of paper, you can identify the true problems and find the true solutions, where there are many ways that you can be wrong and yet still be fundamentally right about some insight. So to provide one example of that, when we started Tessera Therapeutics back in 2018, this was at the point that genome editing had this quantum leap in potential with the advent and development of CRISPR. But we recognized that a key challenge for CRISPR was that it was limited in its ability to make changes to the genome other than knocking out genes. And the problem we identified is that most of the edits that one would want to make to a genome for therapeutic purposes required rewriting a sequence of DNA or actually inserting a fundamentally new sequence of DNA that was in error or missing into a patient's genome. So there is this big gap in what CRISPR could do. And the insight we had is that inside of each of us, there were already these amazing molecular machines known as mobile genetic elements. In fact, inside of every organism, these mobile genetic elements exist, and they exist for the sole purpose of writing DNA and rewriting DNA. And so we knew that there was an opportunity to start a company around understanding the potential of these mobile genetic elements for genetic engineering. And so the question for us became not would this work, but how were we going to get it to work? And we recognized, therefore, that of the almost infinite number of different types of mobile genetic elements that exist in genomes, we were going to find one that would work for our purposes. We might be wrong many, many times, but we were certain to eventually be right. And that has been borne out over time in the incredible work that Tessera has put forward in developing the gene writing platform and the early pipeline at the company.
Yeah, and I'd encourage everybody to go listen to episode 103 with Mike Severino if you want to learn more about Tessera. It was a really interesting episode. I think we have time for maybe two more questions. I was curious about timing with the companies that you start. When you start a deeply scientific company, it's really tricky. You could be too early, you could be too late. These are expensive endeavors to do something that combines prospective sampling, you know, a new form of sequencing that you mentioned, and also integrating, you know, pretty complex computational workflows. How do you think about the transition when you flip the switch from this is the blank sheet of paper and we think we have something that could make a difference to I'm going to start a company, I'm going to put quite a bit of money behind it, because it's easy to get that timing wrong, right? And it's probably pretty important.
Definitely. This is something we try to de-risk at Flagship through our process of explorations, where we find ideas and generate ideas, followed by proto companies where we seed capital to do a few experiments, and then before going to a Series A investment or what we call a NewCo. Those seeds try to take these two early risks off the table, from the $2 million investment we try to ask killer questions to see if there's a there and identify the problems that we'd have to really focus on with the Series A investment in order to scale the company and start to realize the vision. And that does a pretty good job of taking those risks off the table, and it leads us to not start many companies each year. But it's not perfect. It's really not perfect. And you know, one area where I think we were well ahead of the field, I wouldn't say we're too early, but we were so far ahead of the field that in some ways we're now kind of catching up again, I guess the best way to put it was at Sana, where we had at Flagship, in a precursor to Sana called Cobalt Biomedicine, developed the technology for making CAR T cells in vivo. And this technology relied upon the ability to retarget viral-like particles that comprise containing them integrating DNA or a gene editing enzyme to retarget these particles to very specific cell types in the body based upon receptors, say, deliver payload just to CD8 cells or CD4 cells or hematopoietic stem cells. And back in, I think, 2016, 2017, we had this working well. We could make CAR T cells in mice. And Sana began to kind of run with this vision in addition to their cell therapy work. And that work was hard. You know, it was expensive, and it got to a point where I think you have to speak to the folks there about their decision-making that led to this. But at this point, they've prioritized the cell therapy work and slightly deprioritized the in vivo CAR T work. And yet, at the same time, there's this incredible rise of other companies just focused solely on in vivo CAR T or viral-like particles for genome engineering. Really high-impact publications coming out of, say, Jennifer Doudna's lab or David Liu's lab on this topic. And it's incredible work. And it is the exact way that we were thinking back in 2016 and 2015, even about what Cobalt would become. So we were, I'd say, maybe not too early, but ahead of our time, and so much so that other folks in the field are now arriving there, but we never kind of caught the momentum we needed to kind of ride on other people's interest, to ride on that rising tide to where we could be. So it is tricky. It is tricky to get timing right. And I don't think there's any exact science to that.
No, I'm sure there isn't. Curious as a last little quick fire question. One technology, initiative, company, piece of science, something that you think is really interesting that maybe isn't on everybody's radar. It's not on the front page of the New York Times yet. I'm going to say that you can't say somatic genomics because we spent that's going to be my number one for this episode, but you've got to pick a different one. I'm curious if you have something in mind.
Well, I sort of mentioned this at the outset, but I just think we're going to make incredible insights from applying artificial intelligence, machine learning, large language models to genome sequences. This is not a unique insight I have. There are, I'm sure, many people in the world who are way more capable of explaining why that will be the case. But for me, it seems almost obvious. We have at least 8 times more genome sequences than we have, you know, copies of the human word spoken, and yet look at the insights we've made from studying the human spoken word. Yeah. So I think that the ability to learn from our genome, to superpower that learning from our genome with computational copilots or just computers that can do it without our help at all, that is going to fundamentally change the way we do biology. It's going to change the way we do genetics. And that revolution hasn't yet started, but it's going to start soon, and it's going to come really fast once it does.
Yeah, I actually love that insight and prediction. My PhD was focused on the non-coding genome and de novo mutations that cause or contribute to rare disease. And one of the fundamental questions that I think is still with the field today is, what is the grammar of enhancers and other regulatory elements? And I think you're exactly right. Maybe a large language model can figure out the complex language of you know, we've got a simple language of triplet code that we've got relatively figured out, but we have no clue what's going on in the non-coding genome. But maybe all the ingredients are there, and there's a lot to be found. Well, thank you. This was amazing. I learned a ton, and it's been really a pleasure having you on this episode with me.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate the invitation, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Anytime. You are always welcome back. And thanks everyone for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, then you know what I say every single episode. The thing that I really appreciate is just share it with a friend or colleague that you think would enjoy it. And of course, you can always leave us a review on your favorite podcast player. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.